January 7th, 2004. And a bunch of us are gathered here in Bill Wood's residence to talk with Bill about his career at the SEC. I'm Peter Romeo, and with me are Mickey Beach and Bill Morley, all of the Division of Corporation Finance. Bill had a sterling career at the SEC, and we're going to talk to him now about some of the highlights. Bill, perhaps we ought to start at the very beginning. When you came to the SEC, I gather back in the mid-50s after being a Korean War vet and then going to AU. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
What level did you come in at the SEC, and how did you end up at the SEC as opposed to somewhere else?
I was in my senior year at American University working for a bachelor's degree, and I was in the final several months of that. And I had a part-time job here and there to help me with the expenses of school. And I was majoring in economics, and I heard about a job at the SEC, and they had just a few years before, had a big reduction in force, and they hadn't been hiring anybody.
And this is the early Eisenhower years.
Exactly.
Correct? Yeah.
And the strings were loosening a little bit, and the only way I could get in the SEC, which was in 1956, was on a part-time basis as a grade 3 clerk typist.
Wow.
I had to go to civil service and pass the typing test, et cetera, which I barely passed. And so I started in the Office of Personnel as a grade 3 clerk typist. And I worked there about, maybe 6 months. And then I graduated, got my bachelor's, and I interviewed with Barney Woodside, who was director of Corp Fin, in sometime in early 1957. And I switched from personnel as a grade 5 financial analyst in the Corp Fin.
Ah.
So, in essence, my time with Corp Fin started in early 1957 as a grade 5 financial analyst.
Now, Bill, what sort of training did they give you, if any, when you went into the division? And what did you start off doing? I assume you went to a branch.
In those days, they were called sections.
Ah.
There were two sections in a branch, and I really don't remember the makeup of the branches under the ADs in those days, but God almighty, this is really going back. I was assigned an area that we called the bullpen. It was a big open room with desks, and there were staff members seated in there. And there really was no training. There was nothing formal. And my first assignment, our desks were head-to-head with another young man who had been there just about a year. And when he and I chatted, I thought he was a brilliant guy. And we were talking about the work, and I was in a section, if I thought real hard, I could remember some of the names of it. But anyway, the section chief was a guy named Reefer Burney.
Sure.
And he and I got along reasonably well. He was ex-Army of the World War II days, and I was ex-Marine of the war in Korea. So we got along reasonably well. But he was a no-nonsense man on work assignments. I remember he started me out on S-8 stock option.
Uh-huh.
Plan.
That's what I started on, yeah. Too, yeah. In 1969, my first registration.
And I remember reading the thing, and then you had to write a examiner's report and hand it in, and then a more senior guy would review it, you know, and then he'd hand you your work back as though it was a college exam. But there, you know, certain of the comments were marked out, whatever you missed were written in, et cetera, et cetera. However, this young man who was in another section, whom I thought was a really smart guy, and he was a economics major and all that stuff. Well, one day the fellow up in the front office, who it seems to me his name might have been Bob Bagley, he was like the associate director or something. He was the only associate up there. Well, one day the phone rang for this young man, and it said Mr. Bagley wanted to see this young man. He went up. He was gone about 15 minutes. He came back, and his face was ashen. To shorten the story, they terminated him. Well, and this guy was married at the moment, I was single. I wasn't married. This guy was married, had a wife, didn't have any children. But, I mean, I was shocked. I mean, they bottom line, informed him that his work didn't cut it, and, wow. and he was gone. If you remember...
Don't do that anymore.
can't get rid of somebody that...
There was 1 year probation that they...
Right. Oh, that's right. Yeah, within the 1 year. That's right.
And I don't know whether he had any advance warning or not. You know, you're supposed to give them some advance. But anyway, bottom line was they terminated him. Well, I was petrified because I thought this guy was brilliant compared to what I knew. And I remember that had me shell-shocked for about a week that this guy had been terminated. I thought, well, God, what chance have I got in this job? But luckily for me, things, I guess, worked out okay. So the bottom line is my first job was in a section.
Now, how big was that section, Bill? How many people were in
there? Oh, my goodness. There was a section chief. There was a senior attorney. It seems to me the guy's name was like Schneider or something, who became an administrative law judge, ultimately. There was a number two fellow in the branch. He wasn't called senior branch chief or something. I really can't remember his name, but I'd say they, with the secretary, they were probably about maybe 10 people.
It's interesting. What was the makeup at that time? Was it more financial analysts than it was attorneys? It was a much different mix than the current situation.
There was one attorney, usually about three or four financial analysts, one accountant.
That's right, one accountant and a secretary.
And a secretary.
What year did you start?
I started in 60, I think it was.
Okay, yeah. Well, I was 57. Sometime after that, I don't recall if it was before 1960 or just after, but there was a reorganization. The sections were eliminated, and they became branches. So that would... Now, I don't really remember whether that was before 1960 or not. It was not right away, but it was a year or two later. There was this reorganization, and some of the section chiefs didn't become branch chiefs, and many others did. I did some work, you know, as a new man, and I handed my work into your father.
Oh.
And I know he was a section chief, and he became a branch chief, and Reefer Burney became a branch chief.
Do you remember George Scully? That's who I worked for.
The accountant. I do remember George Scully.
He was a section chief. He became a branch chief. That happened a little after I came, so probably in the very early 60s.
That sounds about right. George Scully, the infamous... This was all in the tar paper shack.
I was going to ask you about that. What was life like in that tar paper shack? This is the headquarters of 2nd and D Streets.
That's right. Yeah. 425 2nd Street Northwest. Yeah. That's right. The building had it was a prefab type structure built, I believe, during World War I, and it had a basement area, and then it had at least one level of professionals. I don't know if it had a third story or not. I think not. And there was this little tiny elevator that went down to the basement, and it probably held about, on a good day, maybe 8 people. Maximum. And it was this rickety little old thing, and invariably it got stuck at least once a day. And in the basement there was a lunchroom. It was an old hot shop business. My vague recollection of it was it had awful food, but it was the only game in town if you didn't pack your lunch. The place, maintenance-wise, was not in good condition. There were problems with the plumbing. The walls were cracking and so forth. I do remember George Scully. He had a fist fight with somebody out front one time that caused World War III.
I think that happened before I came, but I did hear about it. Yes, he and I forgot who it was. There was another section chief, wasn't it? It was another professional.
There was another fellow who had a hot temper. I can't remember his name. It seems to me he was not an accountant. He may have been a section chief or a higher-rated analyst.
George Scully wasn't an accountant. He was a section chief.
Oh, well, I thought historically he was an accountant.
I don't think so.
Really?
No, I don't think
so. Well, anyways, the story was that they had words during the day over a work assignment. It was, I mean, nothing. And one thing led to something else. And at the end of the day, the day ended at 5:30, I believe. And everybody was leaving out the front, and they were on the front steps, and the words continued, and Scully punched him. And that ended.
Took their work seriously in those days.
They didn't do anything obvious.
No.
To any of them.
No.
Because George stayed around for another 20 years.
Yeah, he did. I remember the power that was this fellow Bagley.
Bob Bagley, the colonel. We used to call him the colonel.
That's
Bagley.
Right. He looked like the Kentucky... Mm-hmm. Southern gentleman, and everybody was really in awe of him. I never did any work for him.
He's a very formal gentleman, very, very pleasant, very courteous, very formal.
Right.
Nobody would have dreamed of calling him anything but Mr. Bagley to his face.
Right.
None of his first name stuff at all.
I'll tell you something else. In those days also, there was the chairman, and then there was an executive director. His name was Scheidenhelm, A.K. Scheidenhelm, etc. As I came up the ladder, I don't recall that he ever got involved in any of the fundamental running of the divisions. He didn't get into the work. He handled the budgets, the personnel. He signed all the promotions. He signed all those things. But I don't know who appointed him or how long he was there, but that was the then function of the executive director, which as we go along in here, things changed not for the better, which I'll even elaborate on. I don't care. That's right. So I was in the branch mechanism for quite a while until I became branch chief in 1965.
Bill, what sort of interaction did you have with your branch chief, with registrants, with the commission during this early period of your tenure there? I mean, did they allow people like you to talk directly to the commission? Because I understood back in those days, all registrations were reviewed by the commissioners.
That's correct. Yeah. That's right.
We went to the commission.
That's right, yeah. Certainly not as a junior man, but I was allowed to go, we call it in those days, at the table. When you declared a registration statement effective, you had to prepare this rather lengthy memo, where you identified the registrant, the nature and amount of the public offering, a little squib about the business of the company, and then what sort of problems you may have had in the review process. Mm-hmm. And this thing was typed. Each one was typed up. And you would send the papers up, and as I remember, the mechanism for copying was extremely ancient and archaic. I'm not even sure how the girls handled it. As I remember them, they were on lengthy.
They were probably carbon.
I was going to say carbon.
Lengthy paper. No,
no. They had some kind of white paper.
Thermofax or something.
White
it was white,
paper, and
the printing was blue.
Yes, but they couldn't make changes on it. They didn't. They could scratch it out with a razor or something.
And then put white out on it and type over it.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And there was some kind of special machine that you then ran it on or something?
There was a machine that was manual, mm-hmm. and it rolled over the copies, and the final product was started out, I guess, as 8.5 by 11, but then it lengthened as they made the copies or something, and they would have to send up on behalf of the branch examiner, like I forgot what it was, like maybe 15 copies or something, up to the secretary's office. And the secretary of the SEC then was a man named Orville Dubois.
Oh, sure.
And his office would receive these things, and they would log them in, and then they would take the five commissioners, I guess, chairman and four, I believe that was
right.
the count,
yeah.
And their office would get maybe... one plus one copies or something, and then there might be one for Orville's office, and then the staff had their copies. So each registration statement that was being declared effective, I believe there might have been maybe 15 total copies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then Orville would schedule a day and an hour that the examiner had to appear at the commission.
Yeah.
And you'd sit in the back and wait your turn. And as I moved up in grade, I would appear. One fellow in my section in the beginning of the branch was a guy named Matt Epstein.
Oh, yeah.
Matt Epstein.
Later became assistant director.
That's right. And so we would appear in the beginning. I would sit in the back. But as I moved up in the grade, I would go up at the table with him. And then eventually I'd make my own presentation. But you would walk up, sit at the commission table. Everybody would be there, the chairman, the other four. As I recall, in those days, I don't think every one of them had a legal assistant. So the meetings were, you know, not a big deal, okay? And we didn't have any sunshine laws in those days. Everybody in the back of the room were staff members waiting for their appointment. But you'd sit down, and the chairman would say, I understand you're here to talk about XYZ company, and then you'd make a presentation, etc. And so, you know, in those days, as I vaguely remember, it was a big day on the New York Stock Exchange if you had 5 million shares trade, etc. So the volume that we had in those days really, I mean, it was nothing like, you know, today. But as time moved on, it became very apparent that really was not the way to.
Did the commission meet virtually daily?
Yes, I think they did almost every day. Not quite. There was the hot issues market in the early 60s.
Early 60s.
And that kind of accelerated a lot of things and changed the way things were done because all of a sudden there were lots and lots of registration statements. And it even, do you remember, Bill, it even changed the way they were reviewed in the branches. Remember, it got to the point that there was either no review or only one review because they were trying to churn out more registration. This all happened
right before
you were... because I got to the branch at the same time you did. Right before then, in the early 60s, everything got really busy. And I think it was during that time that they began to change the way the registration things were made effective.
That came about, I think, just about the time that I became branch chief. And I became branch chief in 1965. One thing that I did notice in those days, which... had a big impact on what I did later on, was I did become aware that the time in registration, we called it something in the budget, and for the life of me, I can't remember what it was. It was a name that there was an average that we had to report in the budget how many days in registration on average, and it had some little cute little name, but the bottom line was it was the amount of time that lapsed from the date that the registration statement was received to the first letter of comment. And I did notice it was at the Tar Paper Shack because I had been in a softball game and I broke my ankle and I was in a cast.
And I should add here that Bill was one of the all-time great softball pitchers.
But they had such a backlog in those days. And my assistant director, I believe, was a guy named Doug Dunn.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember Doug? Big, tall, gangly guy. Mm-hmm. Remember, he bought a snowplow one time, and the poor guy put his hand down in to clog it, and he came to work. It was big, huge bandage. He was a wonderful guy.
He's a nice guy.
Anyway, but I had the broken leg, and they determined that they had to work everybody overtime on weekends and so forth. I remember humping in there on Saturdays, and we were doing registration statements.
What happened in that period of time, too, was that the law was changed so that companies that were not listed on the exchange, remember when we first went to work there, right? When we went to work there, if you didn't have to file registration, I mean, you didn't have to file current reports, continuous reporting, unless you were on an exchange.
That's right.
And then the law was changed in 64 to make it include what was in the over-the-counter market, and any company that had certain sizes.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, the commission was flooded with all of these new filings.
Not only 33 Act filings. Now you had a great many more 34 Act filings, right?
Well, I do remember in a branch, and I remember all the people that we've mentioned, Ogilvy. I had then moved out of my bullpen area. I had my office, etc. But in the Tar Paper Shack, the walls didn't reach the ceiling. They were like, what do you call it?
Partitions.
Yeah, partitions.
And you have a little walkway, and then you have these little rooms off to the side, like, the branch chief was Reefer Burney, and the AD was Doug Dunn. And one of the branches had Ogilvy in it as the accountant. I forgot who was on the other side, but one day Doug Dunn came down here, And everybody had this massive workload. We had registration statements stacked up. And I wanted to make the point that I did notice in those days that the time in registration before you got your first letter was months. It was months. And it was upsetting everybody. And it bothered me because I wasn't the brain of the neighborhood, but you had to know that if you were a registrant and you filed a good document and you timed the market, you couldn't wait 6 months to get your first letter. I mean, my Lord, the market would fall down and then everybody missed everything. So there was a big problem. There were big stacks of 10Ks that were sure. stacked over here. The paper was laying all over the place. I mean, if the fire marshal ever came in, he'd arrest everybody, etc. But this one day, everybody is so overworked and all this stuff. I remember Doug Dunn was coming down to visit somebody in Ogilvy, was bored or something. He was shooting rubber bands over the petition, etc. And he had a short round, and it landed on Doug Dunn's head. Doug Dunn, I could hear him muttering out there. He put his head in my office, and the rubber band was still there. And he said, I don't think he ever swore. He said, what in the dickens is going on down here? And Ogilvy was so petrified. Anyway. Well, the real problem workload there was that the staff hardly had any time had to look at any of the K reports. Because I remember distinctly the piles of 10Ks. Everybody, in those days, the branches were not alphabetized. We didn't have industry centralization. And so a branch would have a whole run of different types of industries and different types of companies, etc. And then every examiner, that's what they called us, every examiner had his or her share of things. Well, you had so many registration statements that you didn't have time to do the K's, et cetera, et cetera. So they found some money one time, and they decided to work on this overtime basis.
On Saturdays. We worked Saturday morning.
Saturdays, you could come in on a Sunday if you want. I remember Norma, my wife, was a little upset about it. We had little kids at the time and so forth. But I couldn't get around. I had my leg in a cast, so I went in. It didn't really bother me, but it bothered a lot of other people. But it was the only way to get the job done and so forth. And even then, we didn't really get the job done adequately.
Bill, did the commission finally get some more resources when the Kennedy administration came in? Because I know during Eisenhower's period, the commission got cut way back at the beginning and didn't really get a lot of additional personnel, I think, until sometime later.
It seems to me that a lot of people came to work about that time. Do you remember, Bill? That would have been, it would have been in the early 60s, 61, 62. I think the staff size increased. Do you have something in front of you that you're looking at?
Yeah.
Has statistics in it?
I have an old booklet called SEC Concise Directory, and it's dated August 1987, just about when I retired. And in it, they list the current and former commissioners from day one, and what I'm relating it to is under the Kennedy administration, that would have been 1961, and the chairman were Bill Carey from 61 to 64, and Manny Cohen from 64 to 69.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the number of employees, does it?
Oh, no. No. My vague recollection, let me see, 61, I became a branch chief in 65 and an AD in 74. I don't have a recollection of any terrible budgetary problems in those days, but I do, and I don't recall that we had any big influx of dollars to hire staff members, but I don't recall, we didn't have any reduction in force. It seems to me that there may have been some additional staff years added, but there was nothing magnificent or I would remember.
Well, it may have been another one of those situations where it corrected itself because the markets were not as strong. You didn't have the hot issue registration market, which gave you more time to work on the the 34-act stuff. But
And there were other divisions, too, that may have been increasing their employment because there was a lot of reorganization going on at the commission. I don't remember the years, but when it used to be one division was both what is now market reg and enforcement, and they split them in two divisions. Do you remember that, Bill? Well, it used to be the division of trading and markets.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they
trading and exchange.
That happened.
So
yeah, in the early
70s.
That
early 70s. That late? Yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, I don't know what happened before, but Peter and I started in 69, and I know from the time, from 69 right up until 2000, the size of the commission remained very much, you know, around 2,200 to 2,500 people nationwide all the way through that period of time. We never got a lot more people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even though the markets were expanding.
Do you remember, Bill, at what time, remember when they changed the effectiveness of registration instead of going through the whole commission, they appointed one commissioner, and you used to, one commissioner
but a duty
was in
officer.
Charge, and duty officer, mm-hmm. and he made the registrations effective, mm-hmm. and the branch went up with that. And then they decided that the division could make them effective if they were repeat filings, and only the new ones went up mm-hmm. to the duty officer, and then finally mm-hmm. they got to the point that mm-hmm. the division could. That was over. Probably, it seems to me that it was after I became a branch chief, which was the same time as you did, 65, between 65 and 70 was the time when they were.
Because when Peter and I started, they were still making IPOs, still went to the commission. Is that 69? That was just the end of it.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
So it was in that period of time, I guess, that they began slowly to change the process that Bill talked about, where everybody went up for every registration. They began slowly to move it down to the division mm-hmm. level. And I think part of that was because of the huge volume of filings that were becoming effective, the commission didn't have time to deal with all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that was what they did was they delegated authority down to the AD level mm-hmm. to declare registrations effective, and that was somewhere between 1965 and 74.
Yeah.
Now, Bill, during that period, let's say from the mid-50s through the late 60s, there were some pretty memorable division directors here, were there not? Barney Woodside and mm-hmm. wasn't Manny Cohen also a division director at some point?
Yeah. In my time, I went back looking at this document, and I estimated that in my time at the SEC, I worked for 12 chairmen and 10 division directors
wow.
and 24 commission members.
But not during the 50 to 60 period, yeah. because it was Woodside and Shreve.
Woodside and then...
Well,
Manny Cohen,
but
Manny
very
Cohen
briefly.
And then Shreve.
Well, I did them in order. I came in 1956, and that was Barney Woodside.
Right.
The next one was Manny Cohen.
Right.
Yeah.
The next was Ed Worthy.
I forgot about him.
The next was a man named Charlie Shreve.
Yeah, right.
Charlie was only there as a short time. Yeah.
And then Levinson, Rowe, Green, Spencer, Huber, and Linda are the ones that I worked with.
But Levinson was there for about 4 or 5 years. But after Levinson, it began to be a 2-year job. I mean, everybody just held it for 2 years, almost.
At about the end of the Levinson tenure, things began to get bad.
In what way?
if you want to go chronologically, keep going. We'll come to it.
Okay, well, let's talk about you're now moving to becoming a branch chief in the mid-60s. Was that sort of a progression in terms of responsibility? I mean, as I understood it, there were sort of assistant branch chiefs and then branch chiefs, and then if you were good enough, you moved on beyond that.
When I became a branch chief, which was in 1965, there would be an analyst that was known as the assistant, in other words, in the absence of the branch chief, there would be a person that would normally be in charge. But there was no formal job sheet that was written up that way. And also in those days, under each of the ADs, we did not have a senior analyst, a senior accountant, and a senior attorney. Everything was in the branches. There was the AD sitting at the top, but then under him were two branch. There might have been three.
At one point, there were three. Yeah.
There might have been three.
Wow.
But in your absence, there would be a person that would be in charge, and he or she was commonly known as the assistant branch chief. But there was no job sheet at that point. Mm-hmm. That came later.
Now, I assume that when they were selecting new branch chiefs to fill positions, they would what typically take from the ranks of the so-called assistants, informal assistants.
Yeah.
So you were an assistant then, I assume, at some point.
Yeah, I was. There was a posting, because these were competitive jobs. I guess Schedule C's were able to apply.
Do you remember applying for Banshee jobs? I don't remember applying. I don't remember we went through the application process at all, Bill.
I know I did for AD because I was looking through my job.
That was later.
I don't believe we did. I know that I did not apply because I know that Manny Cohen called me in and told me I had it, and I thought, wow, great.
Well, you may be right because I think the guy who called me in was Bagley.
I was so petrified
I couldn't even talk. But
he's going back to his start. He thought he was being fired.
Now, I had worked in, there was a branch chief by the name of George Hibbets, whose wife was named Martha, and she was a secretary. And he was a really an elderly gentleman. And I had, the last job I had before becoming a branch chief, I was the sort of senior guy in Hibbets' branch. And then he retired. But I had worked for two or three different branches in a senior capacity. I worked for Bernie, and then I worked for Hibbets. I did a little work for your father, and maybe some others, I'm not sure. When Hibbets retired, I remember his secretary at that time was a lady by the name of Olivia Roth. Mm-hmm. She was nice, but she was always an unhappy person. I remember she had all kinds of problems. But I do remember... when Hibbets retired, I was asked to go up and visit Bob Bagley, and I went up, and that's when... I think you're probably right. There was no posting.
Do you remember, this is kind of funny, thinking about personnel methods, do you remember how the way you found out if you were transferred from one section to another was they put out a telephone directory? Directory, we had a telephone directory of the division and showed the section chiefs and who was in the section, and they would... put out a new directory, and then you'd look for your name. Don't you remember that? Wow. You'd look for your name, and then you were, that's how you knew
to see
where you
job
were.
I don't remember that, but who you had it under, you know,
they didn't change you. Don't you remember that? Well, I remember the thing would come out, and everybody would be running around looking to see where they were.
We're squared away organization, right? No, I don't remember that. I do remember when I was a branch chief, and we were still the tar paper shack. And when I worked for Reefer Burney, I remember there were a couple of oddball incidents. He had this little tiny office, and it was piled high with paper. He was really a pack rat. But he was a good guy, and he was smart, et cetera, et cetera, in the job. And one of his registrants was either AT&T or IBM or something, and he was going to have a meeting with these folks over... something, over some comments or something. And on the appointed day, and I had been the junior examiner, and on the meeting day, and I'm in Reefer's office, and these guys come in with their $500 suits in those days, maybe now they're $2,000 suits, and Reefer's sitting there behind this huge pile of paper, and he's got this little electronic thing that he heated water in his coffee cup. And as I recall, when it was ready or something, the water would boil and a little whistle would go off. And he had it around behind the desk. There was this big pile of something there. And these guys were seated in the room. They're all cramped in the room. And this whistle went off. And I remember these guys glancing around. What is this? And one of the problems on that, it may have been a stock option plan or something. I forgot what it was. And as you folks remember, you had a registration statement, and if the data in there became more than 16 months old, the law said you had to update it. And that was part of this problem or something. And these fellows were trying to understand exactly what we were talking about. And Reefer, when his bell went off, and Reefer's in the middle of his sentence explaining, I forgot the numbers of the statute, but that you had to update according with section so and so and so. And Reefer is sitting there, the whistle went off, and these guys are looking, and Reefer said, "God damn it, update means update." When that meeting ended, I remember I was a little embarrassed. But anyway, they got the message. That I think they were still allowing exercise of options with a dormant document.
Well, that was before automatic amendments.
That happened a lot in the old days.
When did you move to 500 North Capitol?
Right after 65. When I came to Ranchi, we were still there, but we moved right after that, Bill. It was probably the end of 65.
No, so it was a little later than that, but certainly it was before.
It was the latter part of the 60s,
yeah.
It was at least 66, I think.
As I remember, I don't recall where the SEC was leasing the building. It was assigned to the SEC by GAO or something.
GSA, probably.
Or GSA, yeah. And there was a big thing that... Now, about that time, we must have needed a little more space, or maybe they were hired, but I don't think they came to Corp Fin. Mm-hmm. But we needed a little more space. I know enforcement was raising hell because they had investigatory files lined up in the hallway. They didn't have any storage room. Mm-hmm. And so there was a big movement about relocating a building. And there was a place in Southwest or Southeast Washington called Buzzard's Point.
No, that was later. That was out of 500.
The lease was renewed. That was when it was time, I think, to renew the lease.
That was back in the early 80s.
North Capitol.
That was after 500 North Capitol?
Well, it was when they were renewing the lease on 500. Yeah. That time, when we first went over, we went right over there.
Well, I do remember the move to 500 North Capitol because that's when things started going a little bit bad morale-wise for the staff. That's a place when we moved in, every floor had a color code. You'd have the orange floor, the green floor. The file cabinets were painted those colors. They spent some money on that, but the secretaries were all complaining that they had old-fashioned branch typewriters. You know, they all wanted electric typewriters. Lexitrons hadn't even appeared.
That was later.
But they were all unhappy, and all this money was spent on the color coding thing, etc. So things, you know, started kind of swirling around a little bit there. I thought the Buzzer's Point was before that, but it was after. Well, that was a debacle, the Buzzer's Point thing. Yeah, okay.
That was a big debacle, but that was later.
Bill, I have heard rumors that the assistant directors in particular back in that era were rather imperious and kind of laws to themselves. And I've heard stories about, for example, Charlie Eisenhardt's deep freeze that he had for registrants that he really didn't care for them, so he would kind of put their filings way in the back of the pile and they'd never get to them or whatever. Is that true or is...
I never worked for Charlie Eisenhardt. I heard those as well. I don't know. I can't confirm or deny that.
Well, I did hear a story from Joe Bernstein.
Did you interview Joe Bernstein?
We were not able to. Joe said he really wasn't up to it. He's 88 years old now and just didn't feel that he could do it.
Well, I do remember that the assistant directors had meetings. Was it like twice a week they'd have meetings at 5 o'clock? It was before... Before we became assistant directors, they met. The assistant directors met. It was all part of this. I wouldn't say it was a secret thing, but it was all this.
Is this back in the 60s?
Yeah. The assistant directors met once or twice a week, just the assistant directors, and nobody else was allowed to come. And they ran the division basically is what they did. The assistant directors ran the division. You don't remember that?
Mm-mm. Not that. My ADs were Sid Scanlon. He's the fellow that I replaced. He died of a heart attack.
He died
very
young.
Sid was only 57.
Ralph Hocker. Ralph Hocker was a legend.
He was one of the biggest characters at the commission. Do you remember him?
Absolutely. Very soft-spoken guy. He's one guy you didn't want to cross.
Is he still alive, Ralph?
I don't think so. I doubt it. I don't know. I remember. You couldn't hear him talk. Remember? Yeah. He was so soft-spoken. And you keep getting closer and closer. I remember.
You go into a meeting and
everybody's going around the table. But he came
and what did he say?
Whatever it was, you better listen. He came into our office, and I had a roommate whose name escapes me right now. It was just the two of us, and we shared offices. And my roommate was trying so hard to hear what he said. He was on his knees in front of him, leaning over the chair. He was unbelievable, don't you remember?
Did you say that that he may be alive? Or
I don't think so. He would be quite old.
I used to wonder, well, I don't know. Anyway, okay. He's probably not, so.
Well, Ralph would have to be in his mid-80s at the least at this point.
Because
he was associate director when I
came
there.
I think he was older than Joe.
Is that right?
Well,
close to 90.
He had an incendiary personality. He really did, particularly if, for whatever reason, if he didn't like you, he was really, really bad. And he had a secretary, Evelyn Strawbridge, who was strange as well. And I used to wonder, you know, for some reason, he kind of liked me, or maybe he tolerated me, I don't know. But I remember one day in a meeting in his office, and there was a young branch attorney in there, and I forgot what that young man had worked on, but boy, and he had written something. It may have been a no-action letter or something, I don't know what it was. And Ralph didn't like that young man, and he didn't like what he had written down. And Ralph had this... It was at 500 North Capitol, and his room was long and narrow. He had this big, long table. And at the end of the table was Ralph's desk. It was shaped like a T. And Ralph was trying to tell the young man that he had problems with the draft. And the young man was sitting at the end of the table, and he was trying to hear Ralph. And he's leaning right there. And he said, "Mr. Hocker, I can't understand you, et cetera, et cetera." And Ralph took that document. It was a multi-page, and he threw it. And he didn't mean to throw it that far, but the thing hurtled in the air and hit the kid right in the face.
Oh my!
And I thought, God Almighty! And the kid didn't know what to do. You know, had it been man to man, it probably would have been a fight. But I mean, here he is with the AD, and this was a young man, etc. And I don't know anything about the job assignment, whether the young man had it wrong or not. But I mean, that was really terrible. And at the end of the meeting, I said something to Ralph, and he wasn't about to apologize. He was just a kid. But I often wondered why he was the way he is, except that, did you know that he had a handicapped child that
yes,
was completely bedridden?
Yeah,
and
I knew he had a handicapped child. I remember now, I've forgotten now that you mentioned it. Yeah, I do remember that.
Now, you know, I mean, lots of people have those.
But he also had other children. He had a daughter that won the Spelling Bee.
Yeah, right.
Remember that?
Well, I'm not trying to
defend
what he did, but I think there were...
He was a brilliant man. He probably was one of the smartest men. And he was like 10 steps ahead of you. And that's why you're always trying to catch up. You know? He's like so far ahead talking.
Yeah.
But he was hard to get along with, and he had a hard time. He wanted to be very polite. There weren't too many women around, and I was one of the few women professionals. And I remember we were in a meeting once, and he was so mad, and he was complaining about it, and he said, "Those dirty, dirty bunnies!" And even then, I sort of bit him. I said, "I don't think bunnies is what you had in mind."
Yeah, he was
volatile. Volatile was the word. He was volatile. But, yeah, he liked me, too. And I don't think either one of us would have survived if he hadn't liked us, really. I think he was that powerful.
There were a couple of... I don't remember the AD meetings that she's speaking about. I mean, they certainly might have happened. That there were... And Eisenhart was one, I think. He did get into... if he thought something was wrong or otherwise with a particular registrar, and I think he did... put anchors on their movement.
Joe Bernstein told me a story about how a registrar complained to Manny Cohen, who was then the division director, about how Eisenhart was just not moving his filing. So, and Joe said he was in the room with Eisenhart when Manny came in and said, "What's going on with this filing?" And Eisenhart said, "You know, we've got problems with this registrar. You know, I don't think we should ever make him effect." He said, "Listen, that's not the way we work around here. Move this thing along." He walks out of the room. And he doesn't hardly get around the corner, Joe said, before Eisenhower said, "Joe, just leave that alone over here." But let me get to another aspect of life at the SEC back then. I heard rumors that there was so little turnover as compared to today that somebody almost had to retire or die for anybody to be promoted. Is that true or not true? What was your perception?
The senior grade jobs, that's true. The branch chiefs on up, that's right. That's right.
The attorneys, there was some turnover in the attorneys even in those days. I think the average time for attorneys was probably lower. Uh-huh. But that was certainly true. And as you said, banshees never left unless they were either promoted or died.
I think there is a split between the attorneys and the financial analysts, just because the job market for attorneys on the outside was more volatile. Mm-hmm. There were more places for them to go than there was for a financial analyst, who, even if he was a branch chief, to go at that point.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I mean, it's still the case.
Well, in the early
there's
days,
just, there's so few people that aren't attorneys anymore, mm-hmm. that it doesn't affect it.
That's been a marked change in the commission.
Right. Yeah.
Now, I became an AD in '74, and I think that the staffing problems had begun before that, a little bit before. I don't recall when we started getting the 3-year commitment from attorneys, but it was around 72, 73.
Yeah.
Or 73.
I mean,
did you get a commitment?
When I started, no, I don't think so. No.
It came right after that. But
69?
69.
In the early 70s.
So that's about right. And I didn't become really involved, and it was against my better judgment, with the budget division. I went up in 76 as the associate, and up until that time, the budget had been handled by others upstairs, but the last one that I knew about it was Neil McCoy. Mm-hmm. And I remember him meeting me at the door when I was promoted, and he would just big grin from ear to ear because he dropped the budget on me. And that's when I really became aware of the turnover and the 3-year commitments, and there were some problems in that regard.
Well, you were talking about the change. I mean, Bill mentioned very early.